This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Australia's number one award-winning show for exploring sex, sexuality, and self.
Hide and seek.
Visit joy.org.au/hide and seek. You are listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. Dean Beck and Andrew the Apprentice are with you. And late last year, a large book, which has been a long time coming, titled Male Sex Work and Society, hit the shelves. It was by Professor Victor Minicello and Dr. John Scott. And Dr. John Scott joins us on the line. Thank you very much for making yourself available this evening.
Pleasure to be with you.
Dr. Scott, this was particularly anticipated and purports to be one of the first of its kind. Can you tell us why?
Well, look, there has been quite a bit of research around male sex work in the past. A lot of it coming from a kind of a pathological perspective, looking at it as a form of deviance. So we were taking a bit of a different approach, number one, with the book. There's also been a couple of books that have come out on male sex work, one of them having a global perspective a little bit similar to ours. I think ours was one of the first, though, that's come out that's really covered where things are at the moment. It's state of the art, you know, what's happening right here and now. It's also got a bit of a global aspect to it, so we've invited in various authors from all over the world to contribute to that book, and those people have seemed to be fairly knowledgeable about what they're writing, so we're happy with the end product.
Why is research into male sex workers important?
Good question. Well, look, it's important because I think it can tell us quite a bit about masculinity. That's why I'd like to think it's important. It can tell us a lot about sexuality, sexual desire. It can tell us a little bit about the commodification of the male body. Male sex work's always been around, so I think it's quite significant historically. It's very significant when in trying to understand the gay community, queer communities, even heterosexual communities, straight communities. So I think it's a socially significant phenomenon and something that's often overlooked because, you know, you hear that thing, female sex work, it's the oldest profession, it's been around forever. Well, so has male sex work. And it's just as significant as female sex work. And it's undergoing a lot of change at the moment in terms of how it's structured and organised. So, you know, again, going back to the book, I think, you know, the timing was right to have another look at it.
It's one of those phenomenons that's both loved and loathed. There are elements of queer culture that idolise, sex workers in a sort of pornographic type titillation way, and then there are others that ostracise them accordingly. Why are we so sort of at odds with regards to our relationship with male sex work?
Yeah, look, another good question. Look, I think there's this sense that when you're looking at relationships between men, you haven't got the same kind of power dynamics as you might have between a male and a female. So when we look at female sex work, it's generally looked at as a patriarchal thing. The client's, you know, got this power and control over the passive female sex worker in it. And it's easy to sort of, you know, understand it and theorise it in that way, where I think...
Many in the industry would disagree with you.
I disagree with that myself. That's the stereotype, I guess.
Sure.
And then when we look at male sex work, we'd like to think that male to male sex, you shouldn't have to buy it. We're liberated. You shouldn't have to purchase, you know, this sort of thing. It's degrading or whatever. So I think it has been frowned upon in the gay community. I mean, there are studies that have looked back historically and noted that, you know, in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a particular aversion to male sex work, and it was seen to be something quite outside of gay communities in that period. Part of that may relate also to the stereotypes of male sex work, and certainly the stereotype around in that period too was one of the young male street worker, the hustler, you know, straight identified delinquent. And we're moving away from that stereotype now. So I think there's, you know, again, it's time to reassess some of these older stereotypes.
The sex work industry broadly is obviously subject to government regulation of various forms here in Australia, across the different states. How do you, as researchers, assist in that regulatory framework being established or changed? And how do you change research as regulations change over time?
Okay, there's a lot in that one. My own research, I've tended to be quite liberal in my focus. So I believe it's something that should be minimally regulated. Now, look, not all researchers take the same angle, and there's a lot of debate at the moment around sex work in general, male and female, about, you know, different models of regulation. You know, do you want legalisation where it's still, you know, under certain controls, or decriminalisation where, again, it's managed in a different way, regulated just the same? Should it be treated just as any other business, just as a normal business? And, you know, where do you draw the line at certain things? What age groups are we talking about that get involved in the industry? How many people can work in a building that's called a parlour or a brothel? So, you know, and a lot of people would like to think they're liberal, but at the same time, you've always got that whenever somebody wants to set up a brothel somewhere, you've got that not in my backyard type of attitude. And if people had street workers operating outside of their homes, again, you're going to see some resistance to the idea of sex work. So occasionally you see, you know, these kind of moral panics flare up around the industry. And in terms of the regulation aspect, I think our book generally, the focus is a very liberal one with regards to it. But, you know, regulation comes in many forms, and it's not only criminal regulation, but there's also been a lot of public health and health regulation associated with the sex industry. And so we take a very broad focus on that regulation, and we try to document it, we try to look at it, and why does it occur?
The book, Male Sex Work and Society, is an international study or analysis of male sex work throughout the world. How does cultural influence differ the way we interact with male sex workers?
Yeah, look, not enough is really known about this, and this is something that we wanted to look at more with the book, and we commissioned an author from China to do a bit of a write-up of the scene there. And there are some distinctions in the scene. I mean, certainly the way that masculinity is understood, how it's symbolised, how it's acted out, will vary culturally, as do, you know, the general reactions to male sex work. I think in Anglophone countries, there's been this tendency to conflate male sex work with homosexuality, you know, in the past. And that's led to a lot of the stereotypes that we associate with male sex work in places like Australia, whereas, you know, in other countries, Southeast Asia, the reactions have been quite different. You know, often in some places you'll find it's been largely ignored by regulatory authorities, whereas, you know, in the 1950s and 60s in particular, where there was this tendency to conflate with homosexuality, there was a lot of regulation around it.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. Dean Beck and Andrew the Apprentice are with you. I sound like one of those late night romance shows, Andrew. We are speaking with
Janet!
Dr. Scott!
Janet!
Brad!
Rooker!
Janet!
Dr. Scott!
Janet!
Brad!
Rooker!
Janet!
Dr. Scott!
Janet!
Rocky.
Dr. Scott, not Janet or Rocky or Brad. Dr. Scott, you're together with Victor Minicello, is that right? Did I get that right?
Yes. No, we co-authored the book together, and Victor's on holidays at the moment.
So, lucky man.
He can't be with us tonight.
Now, it's the said to be the first comprehensive interdisciplinary volume devoted to male sex work. What did you discover? What did we get out of this that's new and exciting?
Okay. Look, we documented a couple of changes to the current, you know, state of the industry, and one of the interesting things that's been happening is the impact of technology on the sex industry. So technologies like mobile phone and the internet have had a huge impact on male sex work. If you just take the mobile phone, for example, it allows people to operate in locations they previously wouldn't have been able to. About 10 years ago, I did a study in a rural location which was looking at how the sex industry, sex workers from cities would actually tour around country towns and visit those towns. And that was male, female, transgender. And that was a fairly new development. I think you always had brothels in rural areas, but they often were heterosexual brothels located on the outskirts of town, and they would only be in fairly large towns. So that was a new dynamic. It meant that, you know, new populations were getting access to those services when they previously weren't. And technology's always been big when in terms of understanding the sex industry, everything from long-haul wagons to telephones, landline phones, to the motor car have all had an impact on the sex industry. If you look at the internet, that's been the other big shift, and that's had an impact on, I think, you know, how male sex workers do their work. There's been documented shifts in people away from the streets. Now, the streets always accounted for a small part of the industry, probably, you know, 10-15%, but that seems to be disappearing as a result of the impact of the internet and more online escorting, and that's had a huge impact on what's been going on in the industry as well. So the technology's been one of the big things, and we wanted to somehow touch upon that. The other one is masculinity. There's been a whole batch of research on masculinity that's exploded in the last 20 years, and you know, the male body, the commodification of the male body, and we wanted to tap into a bit of that. And again, as we're talking about before, particularly as masculinity is understood cross-culturally, and so rather than look at the sex industry, you know, as this kind of dangerous space, you know, where you've got to worry about, you know, health, you know, particularly in terms of sexual health, we wanted to look at a few other things, and masculinity and the technologies were right in our focus.
What's the male equivalent of a madam?
The male equivalent? I don't know, actually.
The reason I ask is...
I think about it, possibly.
The reason I ask is that I can imagine that brothels are less necessary, or less... the control that someone that owns a brothel might have over individuals with the technology that you speak of would seem to be less, because they can be individual owner operators and run accordingly.
Yeah, no, look, that's right. some of the early studies of male sex were some of the pioneering ones, and they did come out of Australia, so Australia's always been at the forefront in terms of...
Really?
Yes, it's been something where we have led the research, and there were some studies done back in the 80s which were quite pioneering, and, you know, they were the first studies. I mean, the you know, America and other places, they were looking at male sex workers as, you know, sort of in terms of pathology as deviants, and in Australia we sort of took this option to look more at it as a profession, mm-hmm. Look at it in terms of skills and so on. But some of those early studies actually were looking at parlours, which were more prominent in that period. And but, you know, certainly what we've seen, though, with the rise of the internet, you know, why would you work for a boss, you know, for a madam, or for, you know, a manager, when you can quite easily, with fairly low overheads and everything else, go into business for yourself? You got that flexibility there and everything else. That doesn't mean that people don't work in parlours or brothels, but certainly I think, you know, there's a lot of choice there now in the industry.
A good part of research is always trying to get the point of view of the subjects, I guess. What's the best way, and how do you work around getting sex workers in, you know, to tell their stories in through the research?
Sure. Look. One of the things is, I mean, as social scientists, and this, there was a number of authors that contributed to the study. As social scientists, what we do, I guess, is we go out and we try to talk to as many people as possible. So whether you're doing that by a survey, whether you're using qualitative methods, whether you're looking, you know, online, you know, downloading, you know, information, you know, there's a whole range of things that the researchers in our book did to get that sort of information. So, yeah, look, you know, I've certainly interviewed clients, sex workers in the past. I've, you know, looked at online profiles and, you know, done what we call, you know, sort of content analyses of that, surveys. So there's a whole range of methods. So I guess what we're looking for, though, most of the time is rather than just an individual, we're trying to look at the broader patterns and distill something out of it. And I think that, you know, pays benefits at the end of the day. Again, it's moving away from that kind of, you know, case-by-case pathology. This is, you know, just purely an individual phenomenon, whereas we want to tell more of a story about the bigger picture, I guess, and to tap into things once again, like masculinity and what it means, you know, in that broader way. You know, what does it mean for society? You know, that was what our book was titled, Male Sex Work in Society.
With the onset of HIV in the late 80s, early 90s, that must have impacted what was going on for male sex workers enormously. We have an impeccable record here in this country with regards to HIV and sex work. But tell us how it has impacted globally.
Yeah, look, I think following HIV, there was a greater awareness of sex work. And it's interesting because as you had that phenomenon occurring at the same time as a result of liberation throughout the world as well, and more liberal attitudes emerging, not only around sexuality, but I think, you know, the equality around gender as well. I think that there was another shift that was occurring at that time, and that was a willingness when people went out and they did these surveys, did these interviews, so a willingness to identify as a male sex worker and identify as a gay male sex worker, which was reflecting, I think, you know, a greater kind of confidence in the industry, a more mature outlook in the industry, and increasing professionalisation of the industry. So just as AIDS comes along, you've got this other sort of counter trend. Certainly, what happened though with the AIDS epidemic, a lot of money went into, you know, in terms of the research, most of it was epidemiological, and so really there was this very skewed focus all around sexual health, and I think, you know, that's where we lost, you know, a lot of other understandings around the sex industry. You know, we weren't looking at masculinity. We weren't looking at occupational health and safety. I've interviewed sex workers who have worked in brothels, and you ask them what are their health concerns, and they say, you know, too many people smoking in the building and things like that. You know, it might be psychological health. We forgot all about that. So I think it did skew the focus a bit. But as you say, in Australia, there's been the health outcomes have been quite impeccable here. And we certainly haven't, you know, had an industry that's been irresponsible, I guess, in regards to those health outcomes. That doesn't mean that you don't get medics and other groups coming out haphazardly and saying that, you know, STIs are rising and, you know, it's got something to do with sex workers in the community. I mean, that continues to go on. And most recently, you know, in regards to the mining boom, there was some, you know, accusations that sex workers were spreading STIs and so on in those communities. But again, male sex workers tend to get a little bit overlooked there as well.
The book, Male Sex Work in Society, it doesn't seem to have been written for people in the industry or wanting to get into the industry. Who is it written for?
Yeah, no, it certainly wasn't a sort of a how-to.
No.
And, no, it's largely, I mean, one of our audience, obviously being academics, is an academic audience, a research audience, but, you know, more so than that is, I think, the policy makers. We did have that concern, as I mentioned earlier. I think, you know, there is an interest in looking at that phenomenon of professionalisation of the industry and how do we reflect that in legislation, in the way that we regulate the industry. And, you know, as I noted before, the industry has been quite responsible, you know, socially, you know, currently and in the past. And I don't think that's captured. So we wanted to capture that that message, I guess, what's happening at this very moment. And also look at some of those changes that we've been talking about tonight and document those. At the same time, we try to write it in a way that would mean that it would be accessible to a lay audience who were just interested generally so in male sex work. So there's a chapter on the history of male sex work, and, you know, it's a bit of a potted history. It gives you a bit of a scan what was happening, and, you know, it's not overly academic. So there's a bit of the chapters in the book are quite variable. So if you just wanted to get a broad overview of male sex work, a broad understanding of it that wasn't just about STIs and health, I think this is the go-to book But certainly, no, we didn't write it for people in the industry, because I think people in the industry know what they're doing and have a good understanding of what they're doing. And certainly, you know, they're quite well organised as well, and they do get out a lot of material. So if you want to get involved in the industry, you go to a website, you know, that's sponsored by the industry.
Dr. John Scott, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights this evening on Hide and Seek.
Look, it's been a pleasure to be with you, sir. It's been great chatting.
Male Thank Sex you. Work and Society is currently published, currently out and available via Harrington Park Press. And Dr. John Scott is a professor at the Faculty of Law, School of Justice at the Queensland University of Technology. Coming up next, we'll speak with a male sex worker to find out just what his thoughts are on this definitive guide to male sex work. That's next on Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. We're taking a look at male sex work and society. And we thought we should speak to a male sex worker. Cameron Cox joins us all the way from Sydney. Cameron, welcome.
Yeah, hi Dean. How are you?
Good, thank you. Cameron, you've got a few reservations about this definitive resource on male sex work. What is it that got up your goat when you read it?
Okay, well, it's great, and it was a long-awaited piece of research. Those of us who are male sex workers or are interested in that have been waiting for this for quite a long time. But when it came out, we got an omnibus of essays and collections, some of them quite dated, none of them with sex worker participation as far as we could make out. And on reading through them, we were grateful that last year, around the time of AIDS 2014, we got quite a few advanced galley copies from Bill Cohen, the publisher, for which we're very grateful. But most of us didn't manage to make it through to the end because people just lost interest in it. Every time you turned a page, there was a lot of yes, buts in our mind because people had collected data. But the way they'd either collected it or looked at it left doubts in the minds of actual sex workers as to whether they understood what they were interpreting.
Cameron, how often would you find that you know, a researcher comes up to you and asks you to participate in a survey?
It really seems to depend on the season. At the moment, they're actually coming quite thick and fast. several in the last month, but you can go a little while without being asked or having somebody pop up in your GaDAR profile saying that they're a researcher and please could you fill in this survey monkey.
My take on the book was that it's a bit of a guided tour of the world and male sex work and how I guess things culturally are a little different in each country, but there are so many variations in this. Every individual sex worker is motivated differently, comes from a different background, has different ways in which they engage. Is it even possible to put together the definitive guide to male sex work?
I possibly don't think it is. You know, you can give everybody kudos for trying, and this is a fairly good try at it. But as you can see, it covers a very wide area. It's like digging a lot of little holes, but they're only small holes going down into that overall fabric of male sex work, and it does vary. And one of the criticisms that a lot of people who read the galley copies, who were sex workers, male sex workers, was that it gives a very static look at who we are. And, you know, we're very dynamic. We often change from different types of sex work to other types of sex work. We travel between countries. We do lots of stuff like that and slot into lots of different areas and personas. And a lot of the stuff just looked at us as one group here, another group here, divided into age, divided into ethnicity, sometimes even divided into body type.
Isn't that normal for research, though?
Sorry?
Isn't that normal for research, though?
It is normal for research, I would think, but you can give better overall looks at who and what we are, and I might refer you to the Lancet research that came out at the same time, around the time of AIDS 2014, and the work that was done there on male sex work. In three or four pages, you get a more comprehensive view than I think you get in 500 pages of Male Sex Work and Society.
I tend to agree with you, actually. They were both academic studies, but
yes.
But from, I guess, different perspectives. The one in the Lancet study was far more epidemiological in its approach to social behaviours.
And there's a little bit of contradiction. Male Sex Work in Society tried a little bit to move away from that, which has always been a criticism of the work that's gone into male sex work and the research. And the Lancet went right back into that and actually did a better job of moving away from it while still being in it. I might mention also that all the Lancet stuff that was done on sex work in that issue had considerable sex worker leadership and participation, which Male Sex Work and Society didn't have.
Yeah, I was going to say that's been one of your criticisms of the book. So what you're saying is the writings in the book are observational and not from individuals per se.
Yes, not only that, but it's the interpretation that you get of different facts and factors. I see a statistic slightly differently to a researcher sees it. I think I've written somewhere that these researchers are like people in a foreign land who understand some of the language, some of the culture, but don't get it completely as a native of that land would, because it is a different land if you don't actually live in it yourself and understand how it works.
I comprehend that. I can fully comprehend that. So are we better with this book or not?
That's a really difficult question to answer. It's not to say that there's not some good pieces in the book and there's stuff that you can take away from it, and I wouldn't say don't read it. In fact, I'd recommend that people definitely do read it. But misinterpretation and the misinterpretation that goes on top of misinterpretation when the press and people like that get hold of it, especially on some of the dated studies, there was The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, Fairfax Press took out some stuff about Australia. There's very little stuff about Australia, but there is a study that was done on male sex workers in Australia. And got syndicated all around the world. When you look at the actual study, it's from late last century and not quite in context with what's going on now. It was done at a time where the changes to the industry were quite dramatic. They were internet driven. People were moving into different types of work, arranging it differently. And they're talking about a time, if I remember rightly, where everybody was called Shane and had blonde hair and jet set it off overseas. I see.
And now they're all called Jake.
I was called Shane and had blonde hair and possibly, yeah. But now everybody's muscly with tattoos and dark hair and is possibly called Tate, you know, and I was born in LA.
We are speaking with Cameron Cox, a male sex worker based in Sydney. He's joining us to share some of his thoughts on not only the book Male Sex Work and Society, but Cameron, we'd also like to know what it's like today to be a male sex worker working in Sydney. And we should preface this by saying laws in each state are very different, and it's important to know that.
Okay, well, working in Sydney, it's possibly the best you can get, because here in New South Wales we have a system called decriminalisation, which means that all sex work specific laws have been repealed and that sex workers work basically under the same laws as everybody else does. So we aren't regulated by the police, okay, because not many industries are regulated by the police. They don't walk into many workplaces and tell you what you can do and what you can't do. And that's been a really good thing for sex worker health and safety.
How has that improved health and safety?
Okay, first of all, when you regulate the industry, it tends to split into two, and some parts of the industry go underground and some parts are still stay visible. Outreach organisations have trouble reaching the people who've gone underground. in New South Wales. We're lucky to have a very well-funded outreach organisation, which is funded by the New South Wales Department of Health. In Australia, because even with the states that have got criminal laws, we've still had a very understanding legal system, and we've managed to have records like no reported cases of HIV transmission in a sex work context ever in Australia, which is quite a record to stand on.
It's a pretty good call, isn't it? I mean, really?
Sex workers on the whole also have lower STI rates than the non-sex working population, which puts a sort of lie to the vector of disease argument. That actually the authors, the editors of Male Sex Work and Society refer to in their concluding chapter.
That in the book, one of the things you mention is that the researchers often, and the editors seem to get decriminalisation and legalisation confused. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yes, I can. In the context of sex work, decriminalisation and legalisation have very specific meanings. Decriminalisation, as I mentioned before, is where all criminal laws and regulations that pertain to sex work are removed and sex workers work like any other workers because sex work is work. In a legalised system, it's actually not legalisation so much as partial criminalisation or heavy regulation. So you have a legalised system in Victoria, but whole swathes of stuff that sex workers do, say in New South Wales, and do quite naturally and without any harm to anyone, aren't allowed in Victoria and actually are criminal. So in Victoria, for example, as a private standalone sex worker, I can't do sex work in my own home.
Okay. Because technically here you would be operating a brothel.
Technically I can if I jump through about five dozen hoops and put a notice on my front door for 6 weeks saying that I'm going to do it.
That's not going to happen.
Any of the neighbours object. And, not only that's possibly not good for my own personal health and safety, but it also means that clients who are looking for discretion, and that's most clients, aren't going to come to my place because now known.
There's a bloody great sign on the front door.
Yeah, bloody great sign's been on the front door, yeah.
And here, of course, working the streets is highly illegal as well.
Mm-hmm.
What is the situation in New South Wales?
Okay, so in New South Wales, unfortunately, street-based work is still partially criminalised. At one stage it wasn't, but unfortunately gentrification, which is the problem that you have in St Kilda as well, led to it being partially recriminalised again. So in New South Wales, I can't solicit on the street if you're inside of a school, ground floor dwelling, hospital or church. And that can be at 4 o'clock in the morning, by the way, when there's nobody in the church, the hospital's life really closed down, and all the school kids hopefully are tucked up in bed.
Cameron, tell me why regulation here in Victoria is a bad thing, because I was of the understanding there was a desire by sex workers to have better regulation because there are so many operators that operate a so-called massage service but provide full services here in this state. And can you explain the difference about that and how we can stop these unregistered people working and offering these services that aren't in properly regulated facilities?
Okay. What you're possibly referring to is a bit of a turf war that goes on between those establishments, being parlours and brothels, who've had to spend a lot of money going through a lot of hoops to get their legal status, who are then quite upset if somebody doesn't go through those hoops, which are quite expensive hoops at times, to get a legal brothel status. There is often no difference between the, and I'm putting these in inverted commas, the legal and illegal brothels in Victoria, apart from going through all those hoops. In New South Wales, it's a matter of just of applying for a DA only. Okay, it's not a matter of going further. Even that causes, unfortunately, a few problems. But there's often no difference between those two establishments, in inverted commas, legal and illegal apart from a piece of paper.
And the reason, I guess, that the registered brothels want these facilities closed down is because it's taking away business. And they tend to harbour sex traffickers as well.
I don't think there's any evidence at all that says, first of all, that there's any problem in Victoria or New South Wales as to sex trafficking. It's something that's blown out of proportion by a lot of media and people who have a vested interest in it. If you ask the AFP how much trafficking in the sex industry they find, you'll find that it's very little. There are one or two cases that have come and been proven, but that's about it. And as far as a piece of paper from the Victorian government saying that you're a legal brothel or the lack of that has no bearing on anything to do with purported trafficking.
So, Cameron, you mentioned evidence there. So if we come back in full circle,
yep.
What sort of research would you be looking for to assist in the decriminalisation debate here in Australia across the board?
I think we have the research. We have the research from the Lancet here in New South Wales. We have the 2012 report that the Kirby Institute did for the New South Wales government on decriminalisation, which is part of a larger series of reports that they did, both the Lash reports, and they did one in Victoria and one in Western Australia, that come down very firmly on the side of decriminalisation.
And any further research that was done in other areas, you would ask, of course, that the real-life experiences of sex workers are fully incorporated in that research?
It would be very helpful for the research if sex workers were at the table, had a say in the framing and the interpretation of the questions. It's even better when the research is actually sex worker-led, because sex workers actually know sort of where to lead the research. Gullah's Alliance is the national peak body, has done a lot of work through their migration project that has produced the sort of results that I was quoting before as far as trafficking goes.
Now, in the 6 years that I've been doing Hide and Seek here on Joy, one of the most asked questions of me in private is, how do you become a male sex worker? I'm not quite sure why they're asking me, but I noticed on Twitter, now this is going a couple of months back, I noticed on Twitter an organisation in Sydney called SWOP, which is the Sex Worker Outreach Project, and I rang them up and I asked, could I have a look at some of their material? I got sent a huge show bag full of stuff, which is very comprehensive, and it was like I could start up tomorrow after reading through all of this. Are there facilities like that in Victoria? Because I can't say that I've ever seen such a comprehensive array of materials for someone that is genuinely interested in going into this in an informed manner.
Yeah, well, SWOP in New South Wales is set up for the health and safety of sex workers, and of course people new to the industry are people who really do often need to know about the health and safety, and you probably didn't get all of it because they have heaps and heaps of stuff on their website as well. In Victoria, you have an organisation called RED, who work out of St Kilda. They try very much to fill that gap, but it's not as completely in their remit as it is for SWOP in New South Wales.
Are they a little hamstrung due to our laws?
Your laws, yes, I believe inhibit them a little. I've been told that they're not officially allowed to go to, again in inverted commas, the illegal brothels and to illegal workers. They're also a little bit hamstrung in that they're not a peer-based organisation, as SWOP is, and as many of the other sex worker organisations in other states are. Peer-based means that it's actually sex workers who staff and run and usually sit on the board of those organisations. So, again,
so who works for RED?
Who works for RED?
Yeah. Social workers.
RED are mainly social workers and health workers, yeah.
Right. Cameron, I think you have answered our questions comprehensively on that front.
Okay, no problem.
We should give out SWOP's website, which I don't have handy. Have you got it?
Okay, yeah. Do you know what it is? I can quote you that one almost off by heart. So it's www.swop, for SWOP. So take the out and put an O in for outreach.org.au.
swap.org.au.
Yeah.
And there's tremendous resources online as well.
Yeah, and you can probably get a lead through to Scarlet Alliance, which is the national peak body. That's Scarlet Alliance, all one word, .org.au. And they also list the sex worker organisations in other states as well that do the same sort of work as SWAP.
Cameron Cox, you have been very informative. We are most thankful for your time this evening. We look forward to perhaps catching up with you again in the near future to talk more about the life and times of male sex workers.
That'd be great, Dean. Anytime. Thank you.
You can subscribe to Hide and Seek's podcast for free. Visit joy.org.au/hideandseek for more information. Suggest a topic, a guest, or provide feedback. Email hideandseek@joy.org.au. Hide and Seek is presented by Andrew the Apprentice, James Findlay, and Avi Miller. Post-production by David Cheshire.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek. Hide and Seek.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.